have, Bernie, but it's like a surgeon operating on a close relative or a man acting as his own lawyer in court. Never a good move. Tess's dad gave me a sour expression but said, "I won't speak unless you give me the green light." Let's go upstairs then. Chapter 40. The carpeted stairs made no noise as I climbed to a narrow landing. I turned right and went around the banister to Tessa Leah's bedroom door. Before I could knock, I heard her in there talking. "Rats," Tess said in a soft voice that sounded bewildered. "I saw rats." "Here?" "Believe it. I heard them scratching in the walls. And her screaming. Mom screaming. Mom's always screaming." Tess cried quietly. "Always screaming." She sounded so close. I squatted down and saw a shadow that suggested she was sitting on the floor with her back to the door. I got up, took a deep breath, knocked, and said softly, "Tess?"
"Go away," she said in a whisper that I had to strain to hear.
"It's Alex Cross," I said a little louder. "I wanted to see if we could talk."
"Quiet,"
she snarled.
"I know my rights. I'm not seeing another shrink. No more rats chattering in my closets. No way."
Before I could reply, Tess said,
"Alex, you're the big rat. One chit-chat and you start all this trauma. Put nasty thoughts in my dad's head. Poor Tess. She's crazy enough now. Stick her in a hole."
"I'm not here to stick you in a hole." Tess sniggered.
"Of course you are."
"I'm not. I just want to talk things over." For several seconds, there was no reply. The door creaked as she leaned against it. I heard her shift position on the floor. I glanced over at her father, who stood at the head of the stairs, looking like he was listening to someone drown. "Tess," I said, "can I just talk then? Would that be okay?"
"Whatever you want,"
she said, returning to that bewildered voice.
"Just do it nice and quiet. I hear you fine."
I paused, trying to think ahead, trying to figure out the best way to get her to come out and turn over the
sichunk.
Chapter 41. The sound froze my thoughts. I'd heard it 1,000 times in my life, maybe more. The particular noise a double-action revolver makes when a thumb cocks the hammer into firing position. "Tess," I said, stepping quietly to the side of the door and out of the potential line of fire. "Do you have a gun in there?" In that off voice, she said,
"Hate rats in my closets."
I glanced at her father, motioned for him to be patient, and said, "A lot of people care about you, Tess. They'd like to help you. I'd like to come in and help you. Your dad would too."
"No need,"
Tess said wearily, sounding as if she might be falling asleep.
"Ask my dad. Tessie's an impatient girl. Can't wait for pest control to do its thing."
"Will you do me a favor? Will you put the gun down beside you at least?"
"No, Alex," she whispered. "What would be the point of that?"
I decided to shake her a bit. "I asked you before if you were self-medicating. You said no. But your dad just showed me 12 different meds in your kitchen." After a pause, she said,
"Legitimate prescriptions from licensed docs."
"Except I don't think the other doctors knew everything you'd been prescribed, Tess," I said. "There are several drugs down there, antidepressants and antipsychotics, that pose a significant risk when combined. You could have a very serious drug interaction, one that could stop your heart, trigger a stroke, potentially damage your brain, wipe out your long-term memory." In a slow, modulated whisper, Tess said,
"Hasn't worked." yet.
The gun barked. It startled me so badly I jumped back before feeling the horror and disbelief well in me. Tess had shot herself. She was dead, right there on the other side of that door. My knees went to rubber and I grabbed at the banister, feeling like I was going to be sick. Bernie Aaliyah roared in panic and despair.
No!
He limped fast to her door and pounded on it. Tess! Answer me! Tess, you answer me right now! In the short silence that followed, I said, Bernie? Tess's father twisted his head to look at me enraged.
Shut up, you! I never should have called you Cross. You've killed her. That's what you've done.
Part 3. The Prosecution of Alex Cross. Chapter 42. 4 weeks later. Striking her gavel twice, Judge Priscilla Larch peered out through thick-lensed glasses and in a gravelly voice said,
The People versus Alex Cross. This court will come to order. Sergeant Holm, you may seat the jury.
Yes, Your Honor, the bailiff said, and he went out.
I'm praying we chose right, my niece Naomi said.
Anita Marley nodded stiffly and looked to her opening arguments, not bothering to watch the 5 men and 7 women who held my fate in their hands now filing into the courtroom and taking their places in the jury box. I understood why. Anita was still upset with me about jury selection. During voir dire, the questioning of potential jurors by the prosecution and defense prior to jury selection, we disagreed over 2 picks, Juror 5 and Juror 11. 5 was a man in his 70s who had something wrong with his spine. His upper back was twisted and hunched. He walked slowly with a cane and had to turn his shoulders and ribcage to look up at you. Juror 5 had also been sharp in his answers, especially when it came to describing his general skepticism about nearly everything in life. An electrical engineer before retiring, he said he took his time making decisions, tried to get to the truth before he acted, and was firm in his convictions. Anita had wanted to dismiss Juror 5 because he had a friend whose son had been shot by the Baltimore police. But he also said that he had nothing against cops. They have a tough job. I can apply the law fairly given that. I overruled Anita's objection to Juror 5, telling her we wanted people skeptical enough to hear the facts and honest enough to deal with them fairly. Juror 11 was a big, stylish, and beautiful woman in a gray Chanel suit. A brassy redhead, she had a beaming smile, an infectious laugh, and an accent as smooth as West Texas honey. She worked for a big PR firm in D.C. and was friends with several U.S. Capitol Police officers. Anita wanted her off the jury because a police officer had hit her brother with a baton during a riot at a music festival in Austin. But Juror 11 had also said that her brother deserved to be hit because he was drunk, crazy, and took a swing at 2 cops. I reminded Anita of that and overruled her. The others we agreed on. On the whole, my jury seemed a cross-section of the Capitol. In addition to jurors 5 and 11, there was a thin, hyper-woman who worked as a U.S. Senate aide and was furious she hadn't been excused from serving. A beefy guy who wrote a tax newsletter. A lobbyist for agribusiness. And a young mother from Adams Morgan who seemed delighted to serve, apparently seeing it as an extended break from her kids. There was also a male nurse who worked at GW Medical Center, a retired teacher, and a bartender at the Four Seasons Hotel. 2 grandmothers and an ex-merchant mariner completed the dozen people who would decide whether I would go on with my life or take a very long detour into a federal penitentiary. When they were seated, Judge Larch said, "The floor is yours, Mr. Wills." Chapter 43. Thank you, Judge, the assistant U.S. attorney said, and he got up. Wills tucked his shirt in over his big old belly, smiled sheepishly, ambled midway to the bench, and stopped. The federal prosecutor took a breath, played the silence a moment, and then said, Some police officers in America believe the judicial system is in ruins.
They get so frustrated. They begin to see themselves as judge and jury, and then executioner. They do.
I am with the U.S. Justice Department, and I'm telling you that in every major police force in this country, there is one or a pair or even a handful of cops who believe they are above the law. Wills paused and then directed his attention at me. The defendant, Alex Cross, is a prime example of a police officer who thinks he is above the law. A cop who believes that he alone can identify evil and that he alone has the ability to stop it, even if it means his killing someone in the process.
The prosecutor nodded to Athena Carlisle, his co-counsel, and she hit a button on her computer, bringing up two pictures, a man and a woman, on a screen opposite the jury. Wells said,
"Virginia Winslow was a mom, a welder, and a survivor of terrible abuse during her years married to Gary Sinigi."
"Virginia's a martyr!"
someone in the courtroom yelled. I pivoted in my chair to see a bearded man with wild eyes standing in the aisle and pumping his fist. He shouted,
"So's Lenny Diggs!"
Judge Larch banged her gavel.
"Bailiff, have this man removed from my court. I said I would not tolerate any outbursts, and I meant it."
"Both were persecuted," the man shouted. "Both were killed by the chief persecutor, Alex Cross."
Two U.S. Marshals grabbed the guy, who offered no resistance and said nothing more as he was taken out. I guess he figured he'd made his point.
"The jury will ignore the outburst," Judge Larch said. "Mr. Wills, make it snappy. We've got a lot of ground to cover."
"Yes, Judge," the prosecutor said, and he walked to the jury box.
"Ladies and gentlemen, it is critical for you to know one thing about Virginia Winslow. She was sick and tired of being targeted by law enforcement simply because she'd unknowingly been married to a vicious criminal. Virginia changed her last name after divorcing Gary Sinigi. The cops still came for her. She moved. They found her. She tried to hide her teenage son, Dylan, from his father's legacy. But in this case, the defendant, Cross, acted to cruelly change that, seeking out and telling the boy in lurid detail what his father had done and making the young man feel as if he were also to blame.
Wills turned to look at me.
Alex Cross made him feel that way because Alex Cross did indeed hold Gary Sinigi's son, his ex-wife, and everyone else who had ever been associated with the deceased killer partially responsible for the man's crimes. Alex Cross was obsessed with Gary Sinigi. He hated all things Sinigi with such a passion that he decided he had to go above the law. He decided these Sinigi people had to die, be wiped off the face of the earth. He'd kill every one of them.
Wills paused and looked around. I heard Ollie whisper,
"He's lying, isn't he, Damon? That man is standing there and lying about Dad. How come no one's saying a thing?"
"Shh," Damon said. "We'll get our chance." The assistant U.S. attorney went on.
"The evidence will show that Detective Cross used intimidation tactics to get an admirer of the late Gary Sinigi to take him to meet the leader of a group of people interested in the dead killer. Alex Cross defied well-established police protocol. He went alone, without backup. He marched into what turned out to be a trap. A trap that featured people wearing masks and clothes that made them look like Gary Sinigi, all part of a performance designed to evoke a reaction from Detective Cross.
They got more of a reaction than they expected," Will said somberly. "Alex Cross shot three of them down in cold blood. Virginia Winslow died first. Cross shot and killed a cameraman, Leonard Diggs, next. Then he tried to kill Claude Watkins. Watkins lived, but he's paralyzed and confined to a wheelchair. Now, you will hear the defense assert that all three victims were armed and threatening the detective when he shot them. That is a false statement, and the evidence will prove it."
The prosecutor put both his hands on the jury box rail and looked at each of the jurors in turn. "Dr. Cross and other rogue cops across the country have gone above the law and gotten away with murder over and over again.
Isn't it time that we, as a nation, as a people, say stop? That's enough. No more killings by cop.
Wills paused for dramatic effect. And then, with anger laced through his voice, he said,
I'm asking you, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, to look at the evidence. And I'm asking you to say no more. I'm asking you to say, that's enough, Alex Cross. You might be a great detective. You might have solved many cases. But you will not kill with callous disregard for our judicial system ever again. You will be judged on the facts in a court of law, and you will be found guilty, and you will be punished for your cold-blooded actions.
Chapter 44. When Will sat down, Judge Larch wrapped her gavel, called for a 10-minute recess, and hurried off the bench. I glanced at the jury and saw jurors 5 and 11 looking at me as if I were some lower order of species.
That went well, Anita Marley said.
If that went well, I'd like to see your version of getting crucified, I said.
Take a breath, Uncle Alex, Naomi said. It's not that bad.
Pretty damning.
No, Naomi's right, Anita said. Did you notice there weren't a whole lot of bomb-proof facts mentioned? They've got a few, but not enough.
If they had enough, they'd have said so. That's why prosecutors try to tie in some national trend to their cases.
All spin aside, it means they haven't got enough to try the case on the merits.
Before I could reply, I heard,
Alex?
I looked over and saw Bree at the bar. She waved her cell phone at me.
I've got to go.
I walked over and hugged her. Thanks for being here.
I want to be here every minute, she said, and she kissed my cheek.
I know, but go to work. I've got good people fighting for me.
Bree wiped out a tear when we broke apart, nodded, and left with a little wiggle of her fingers at Nana Mama, Damon, and Ali.
I winked at my sons and my grandmother. Ali winked back. Damon smiled weakly. Nana nodded without conviction and worried the small string of rosary beads she'd brought along.
All rise, the bailiff called.
Judge Larch strode back into the court. I was too far away to smell it, but I knew she'd have the odor of Marlboro cigarettes about her. Larch was forever trying to quit and never succeeding, which contributed to her general surliness on the bench. At least, that's what her clerk had told me once.
Ms. Marley, you may proceed, Judge Larch said, and she popped a mint in her mouth.
My defense attorney looked at me and smiled. Then she put her hand on my shoulder. She stood up and kept her hand there, gazing at the jury, sweeping her eyes over each one of them.
Not this man, Anita said, and she paused for several moments. This man is not the creature that Mr. Wills just described. This good man is Alex Cross, and let me tell you a few hard facts about Dr. Cross, facts that cannot be denied or molded like mud into something other than the truth.
She left my side.
Alex Cross won a scholarship to Johns Hopkins University, where he graduated with high honors. He took a Ph.D. there in criminal psychology as well. He worked 7 years as a member of the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, the people who hunt serial killers by profiling them. Cumulatively, he has been a homicide detective with the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department for more than 15 years. During all that time with the FBI and DC Metro, Dr. Cross has been repeatedly cited for, among other things, bravery in defense of fellow police officers, arresting bombers, rescuing kidnapped victims, capturing mass murderers, and defeating a terrorist plot to blow up Union Station. Did I mention that the last citation was signed by the President of the United States? It was.
Chapter 45. Juror 5 was craning his neck and shoulders to look at me, and Juror 11 seemed impressed enough to jot something down on her notepad.
Sadly, that is why the U.S. Attorney's Office is pressing this case, Anita Marley said, returning to my side. You see, with the rash of police shootings across the country, the Justice Department needs a prominent individual to prosecute as a way of demonstrating to the outraged masses that the government is actually doing something about police violence. She put her hand back on my shoulder and said, "But ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you not to be swayed by the government's tactics because the facts of this case are on this good man's side, and they demonstrate far, far beyond a reasonable doubt that he is innocent. Let me lay them out for you." Anita took the jurors through a straightforward summary of the events that led me to shoot three followers of Gary Sinigi in self-defense, starting with telling them about the Sinigi, a violent cult that had risen up around the myth of the late kidnapper and bomber. "The cult targeted the investigators who had hunted Gary Sinigi," Anita said. "They targeted Detective John Sampson, and they targeted Alex Cross. They made death threats to Dr. Cross and to his family." Then she explained how the FBI Cyber Division identified a woman named Kimiko Binks as the secretive builder of a website dedicated to the cult. Records showed that Binks had a partner in the website named Claude Watkins. When he was 16, Watkins was tried as an adult and convicted of carving the skin off a little girl's fingers. Miss Binks told Dr. Cross she could take him to see Watkins, who had served his time and was now a successful artist, Anita said. Miss Binks led Dr. Cross to an abandoned factory where Watkins and a group of his followers were waiting, all dressed up as Sinigi using Hollywood-quality masks. She nodded to Naomi, who hit a button on her laptop. An old mugshot of Gary Sinigi popped up on the courtroom screen, along with a crime scene photograph of one of the masks. "Three of the cult members wearing masks like this one were armed," Anita said. "They carried nickel-plated pistols that they used to threaten Detective Cross, an officer in the course of his duties. Dr. Cross gave them fair warning, and then he defended himself. When he left the crime scene to meet police and ambulances he'd called to the factory, someone took the three pistols. The defense believes a member of the cult did this in order to frame Dr. Cross, to portray him as yet another policeman gone over the edge." Anita paused and then showed outrage. "The U.S. Attorney's Office should be ashamed for buying into what is obviously a fabricated story. The Justice Department and the Attorney General should be ashamed as well. They don't care about Alex Cross's exemplary record with the FBI. They don't care about the great good he's done repeatedly in the course of his career. They just want a high-profile scapegoat, and Dr. Cross fits the bill." She crossed back to me, put her hand on my shoulder, and said in an even forceful tone, "But ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I say to you, not Alex Cross. Not this good man. This good man will not be made a scapegoat. This good man's reputation as one of the country's finest detectives will not be dragged through the mud. Dr. Cross's remarkable career will not be ruined, and he will never see the inside of a prison cell because this good man is completely innocent of these charges." Chapter 46. Priscilla Larch called for a lunch recess at the end of Anita Marley's opening argument, and judging from the body language of jurors 5 and 11 as they left for the jury room, it seemed that my lawyer's remarks had evened the score. Nana Mama thought Anita's speech was strong as well, but my grandmother was tired after the stressful morning and said she was going home for a nap. I encouraged the kids to go with her. Both boys refused. Janny decided to accompany Nana, do some studying, then go to practice. Damon and Ali went out for lunch. Anita, Naomi, and I ate takeout Chinese in a conference room down the hall from the courtroom as we went over the testimony of several witnesses who might be particularly hostile to my case. Assistant U.S. Attorney Wills had a reputation for not holding back at trial. He liked to attack with his strongest evidence right off the bat to make a deep impression on the jury. We were preparing for a rough afternoon. We had no idea how rough it would be. The prosecution started the after-lunch proceedings by calling D.C. Metro Detective Harry Chan, the first investigator to arrive at the factory after the shootings. Two patrolmen had driven into the lot 5 minutes before Chan, but I'd kept them outside pending arrival of detectives and criminologists. "He wanted to keep the scene as uncontaminated as possible," Chan said. Can you describe the defendant when you first encountered him that day? Wills asked.
He was excited, talking fast, the detective said. He was sweating and pacing. He complained of being dizzy and having a headache.
What happened then?
The ambulances and Chief Stone arrived, he said. She wanted him, Dr. Cross, her husband, kept away from the scene, and she took him home without giving me much time to interview him. I entered the factory with the EMTs and my partner, Detective Lorraine McGee. When we got to Victim 1, Virginia Winslow, she was dead of a gunshot wound. Victim 2, Leonard Diggs, was barely clinging to life. Victim 3, Claude Watkins, was more alert but badly wounded. Diggs died en route to the hospital.
The prosecutor paused as if to think about that and then said,
Did you see a nickel-plated pistol in the hands of or around any of the three victims?
We did not.
And did crime scene techs find pistols hidden in the factory?
No, Chan said.
Any footprints near the victims?
Lots of them, he said.
Watkins and some of his followers had been living there for some time.
Nothing conclusive?
Not in my book.
Any gunpowder residue on the hands of any of the victims?
No.
Your witness, the prosecutor said to Anita Marley. Anita smiled and stood.
Tell me, Detective Chan, have you ever been in a gunfight with three assailants?
No.
But given your years of experience, would it be reasonable to say that having survived such an ordeal, Dr. Cross would be excited, sweating, talking fast, pacing out of nervous energy, and even dizzy or suffering a headache from the gunshots?
Chan said,
I suppose it's as reasonable as saying Dr. Cross had just shot three people for his own ends and was acting that way because he was trying to figure out if he'd done it well enough to fool me.
Anita looked annoyed.
Objection, Judge. Will the court instruct the witness to answer my question?
Asked and answered, Counselor, Larch said. Motion denied.
Defense reserves the right to recall Detective Chan at a later time, my attorney said, and she sat down.
The United States calls Norman Nixon to the stand, Will said.
Jesus, they're not fooling around, Naomi muttered under her breath.
Chapter 47. Norman Nixon was a hearty-looking man in his 50s, neatly groomed with scrubbed skin, slick iron-gray hair, and a competent, earnest expression. He wore a khaki suit and a blue striped tie, and he carried a file folder to the witness stand. After Nixon was sworn in, Wills quickly established the witness's bona fides as an expert on police shootings. Nixon had been a decorated cop in Chicago before joining the FBI, where he had worked as an investigator in the Civil Rights Division. He was involved in the U.S. government's investigation into police killings. After his retirement from the Bureau, Nixon continued to study the forces that contributed to citizens' death by cop.
Sometimes the officers are racist, Nixon said. Sometimes the officers just burned out from the day-to-day pressure of the job and is feeling inordinately threatened. And sometimes, more often than you'd think, the police officer shoots because he believes he's above the law.
Wills looked at the jury.
In your opinion, Mr. Nixon, does Alex Cross fit the profile of a police officer who believes he's above the law?
Objection, argumentative. Anita said.
Overruled, Judge Larch said. Answer the question, Mr. Nixon.
He does fit the profile, Nixon said. In fact, he's a prime example of the phenomenon.
A prime example, Will said.
What does that mean?
It means I've studied him at length, Nixon said, looking earnestly in my direction.
It means I've researched every shooting Dr. Cross has ever been involved in.
Wait, the prosecutor said. Dr. Cross has been involved in shootings other than the three in question today?
Anita sprang to her feet. Objection! Relevance!
Will said, We're trying to give the jury the context in which these three shootings took place.
Overruled, Larch said.
Judge!
Overruled!
Will said, Was Alex Cross involved in other shootings before the three in question?
Yes,
Nixon said. How many times does the average police officer in America discharge his weapon in the course of a career?
Zero,
Nixon said.
The vast majority of police officers never fire their weapon in the line of duty.
Zero, Will said. And how many times has Dr. Cross discharged a weapon in the course of his careers at the FBI and DC Metro Police?
The witness shifted in his chair, said,
I don't have all the records. Some are sealed. But just from the public documents I've looked at, Alex Cross has fired his weapon at least 31 times.
I blinked and felt my stomach go sour. There was a louder reaction in the audience, which caused Judge Larch to pound her gavel.
Order!
By their expressions, jurors 5 and 11 had turned against me. And no wonder. I was as shocked as they were to hear the number.
31 times? Is that true? And have I shot more than that?
He said, at least, didn't he?
Will said, can you break down the shots for us in a meaningful way?
Nixon nodded.
The records I've seen indicate that Dr. Cross missed 14 times and wounded someone 8 times.
And the other 9 times Dr. Cross pulled his trigger in the line of duty?
His shots were perfect, Nixon said. All of his victims died.
Chapter 48.
By the end of the first day of the trial, I felt like that side of beef Rocky Balboa used as a punching bag.
For 3 solid hours, Wills and Nixon had kept up a relentless barrage of facts about the 9 deadly shooting incidents that they said collectively cast me as a cop who believed he was above the law.
They've almost got me believing it, I said after court was adjourned for the evening.
We'd gone to a conference room to reassess before heading home.
Anita said, you must absolutely not believe it.
Naomi nodded.
She's right. Your belief in your innocence has to shine through your body language. The jury will pick up on the slightest doubt you feel.
My lead attorney put her hand on my forearm. This is classic Nathan Wills, from what I understand, and we still have more than a few cards up our sleeves. Go home, Alex. Be with your family. Don't watch the news. We'll see you in the morning.
I nodded. Samson's picking me up in the garage.
Perfect, Naomi said.
And have you thought about that interview request from Gail King?
I don't see an upside.
My niece said,
the upside is you get to tell your story to a national audience and counter all the horrible things people have been saying about you.
I'll think about it, I said and left.
Samson was waiting for me in the garage in his Jeep Grand Cherokee.
How'd it go? He asked after I'd shut the door.
Slightly better than the Spanish Inquisition.
Shit. And here I was, hoping the Iron Maiden and the Rack were making a comeback in our legal system.
I glanced at him, saw him grinning and laughed.
Yeah, I get it. I suppose it could have been worse. I just don't know how.
We left the courthouse garage, skirted around the media mob waiting for me to exit the building and headed home.
Anything I can do, Samson said.
Not unless you can speed up lab work faster than Bree can.
He looked over at me, puzzled.
Some saliva tests Anita wanted done. They might help.
With what?
I can't talk about it.
I understand, he said, but his tone said he didn't, and there was a strained silence between us the rest of the ride.
Samson pulled over well down the street from the small crowd of journalists camped outside my house.
You best take the alley home.
It'd be easier, I said.
Thanks for being a stand-up guy, John.
He paused and then nodded and said, I have a great role model.
He drove away. Knowing Samson still had my back, I felt okay as I walked down the alley that ran behind my block. Even better, the air smelled like garlic and basil when I went through the back gate and stole through the side door.
Ollie and Janny were on the couch in the great room, watching the NBC Evening News with Lester Holt when I came in.
Dad!
Ollie said, running over and hugging me. Janny's eyes avoided mine. She was barefoot but still in her warm-ups, watching the screen. Holt wrapped up a piece on the latest budget impasse in Congress and then turned grim and said,
31 times.
Behind him, a dark silhouette of a man appeared. He held a pistol. Beneath the image, a caption read, Police gone bad?
Holt said, The trial of noted detective Alex Cross opened today in Washington, D.C., amid what prosecutors are saying is a long-needed discussion in America about police gone bad and gone violent above the law. The screen jumped to footage of me and Anita entering the courthouse that morning, with Holt talking in a voiceover. After opening statements, the prosecution brought in star witness Norman Nixon, and almost immediately there were fireworks and harsh accusations, including the stunning news that Detective Cross has fired his weapon at least 31 times in the course of duty when the average police officer never fires his gun at all. Before the two killings he's on trial for, Cross's shots have proven fatal 9 times. The screen jumped to a frizzy-haired woman identified as a sociology professor sitting in front of a wall of books.
31 times? She said. He kills 9 before these two? I'm sorry, but this is a cop who shoots first and asks questions later.
Chapter 49. Turn it off, I said. Janny didn't move.
Janny,
Ali said, going over and grabbing the remote.
Don't, she said. I want to know how bad it really is.
Ali hit the power button and the screen went dark. Janny glared at him and then at me before jumping up and leaving the room.
What's with her? Ali said.
I gazed after Janny as she stormed through the kitchen. My grandmother popped up from behind the counter. I'll ask later, I said. And then I went into the kitchen where Nana Mama was finishing dinner preparations. She patted me on the back.
Hang in there. The truth will out, son. It always does.
I know, I said, but there was little conviction in it. Nana Mama motioned me into her arms. It was still a miracle to me how such a tiny old woman could radiate so much positive energy.
Don't let them get you down, she said, rubbing my back. When they hear your side of what happened, old Lester Dolt and Chuck Fraud will be singing a different song.
I laughed and looked down at her. Lester Dolt and Chuck Fraud?
That's what I call him and the political reporter guy.
But Lester Holt is not a dolt.
And Chuck Todd's not a fraud, Nana Mama said. But calling them that when all the news is depressing gives me a reason to smile.
I gazed into my grandmother's eyes and saw both confidence and fear.
You are one complicated old lady, I said, touching her cheek. I should hope so, she said, pulling away. Dinner in 15 minutes?
What's cooking?
Chicken roasted and Nana's special herb rub. Go on, wash up. Bree texted, she'll be home any minute.
I was about to head up the stairs when Bree came through the front door. There was strain everywhere about her, and she dropped her gaze and hesitated before coming into my arms.
I'm sorry I wasn't there, Bree said. It must have been awful.
Sobering, I said. 31 times. I had no idea. Bree lifted her head to look me in the eyes with cold curiosity.
And the 9 dead and the 8 wounded?
I remember each and every one of them, I said. You can't forget things like that, ever.
Even when they were righteous shoots. She studied me, her eyes welling with tears, then hugged me tight.
Jesus, she said hoarsely. They want to tear you apart.
They better pull hard, I said, and I kissed her head. Chapter 50. Gretchen Lindell lay curled up on her filthy mattress, scratching her head, staring at the plywood walls that imprisoned her, and wondered if her torture would ever end. Coated in grime, her nightgown in tatters, Gretchen reeked, and her feet were cut and swollen. Her hair was tangled with burrs, leaves, and twigs. She couldn't pick them out, no matter how hard she tried, and she hadn't tried in days, at least since the last time they'd come for her. How long had that been? 5 days ago? 6? She couldn't tell, and in the end, it didn't matter. I'm here until I'm not, Gretchen thought. It's like I'm not even me already. How bad can the last step be? The big man in black, the one wearing the tinted paintball visor and carrying the knife, had come for her 4 times since her kidnapping. Each time it had been dusk when he'd untied her blindfold and she'd found herself in the woods. There were 2 or 3 others there, all dressed similarly, all laughing at her when the big one said, "Run now. Give yourself a chance. And give the boys a show."
Gretchen played competitive volleyball, and she ran hard the first time, took off, not caring about the stones and sticks that jabbed her bare feet. She'd gotten ahead of them and thought she'd lost them, before it turned dark. Then they were all suddenly around her, yelling in the woods, taunting and calling.
Where are you, Blondie? Where are you, Uptown Girl?
They had to have been wearing night vision goggles or something like that, because they caught her every time. And every time, they'd taken her right to the point where she believed with every cell that they were going to kill her, slit her throat, and watch her bleed out, all on camera, all to their delight. The first three times they'd hunted her, Gretchen had survived by focusing on her friends and her parents, and on how desperately she wanted to see them all again, especially her dad. She shared a special relationship with him, a real friendship as well as respect and love. It would kill him, she'd thought when she'd wanted to give up and ask them to end it. It would kill him, and I can't do that to him, to either of them. The fourth time they'd hunted Gretchen, the last time they'd hunted her, had been different. They'd barely let her run before catching her. They'd dragged her to a building in the woods. The big one had torn off her panties while the others held her down. She'd gone to a far-off place in her mind then, where there was no hurt, no feelings at all, as if she'd already found death. That feeling of passing, of being already gone from her body, had stayed with her even after they were done, even after they'd thrown her back in her plywood box, even after days without eating. Someone threw the door's deadbolts. Gretchen cringed and tried to keep staring at the plywood wall.
You don't eat. You don't deserve to play the game,
the strange electronic voice said.
You don't eat. Drink. Keep your strength up. You don't deserve to live.
I don't want to live like this.
We kind of thought that.
She looked at the big guy in black wearing the GoPro camera and the paintball visor and saw something that cut through her feelings of nothingness, made her retreat. He wasn't carrying that knife he'd brought the first four times they'd played the game. This time, he carried a coil of rope tied at one end into a hangman's noose. Chapter 51. Judge Larch gaveled the court to order at precisely 8 a.m. She took care of several administrative issues before reminding Norman Nixon he was still under oath when he returned to the witness stand. "Ms. Marley," Larch said, "your cross-examination, please." Anita patted me on the thigh, got up, and said, "Mr. Nixon, of the 9 fatal shooting incidents you looked at involving my client, how many were judged wrongful police conduct?" He shifted uncomfortably.
"None.
So you're saying that in each of these cases, Alex Cross was investigated and found to have taken prudent action in accord with police and FBI protocol?"
"I don't know how prudent when you end up with a dead suspect."
"Objection," Anita said.
"Sustained," Judge Larch said. "But rephrase, Miss Marley."
Anita seemed taken aback for a moment. Then she said, "Was Dr. Cross found to be in compliance with police and FBI protocols in each of those 9 shootings?" Nixon acted like he had something stuck in his teeth, but eventually said,
"He was."
All 9?
All 9.
"And in the cases of wounding?"
"Yes, but..."
"A simple yes will do, Mr. Nixon. Since you have had a chance to look at Dr. Cross's record in such detail, would it be fair to say that the criminals involved were dangerous people, violent people?"
"Doesn't mean they had to die by a police bullet,"
Nixon said. "It's a yes or no question."
"Yes, they were dangerous."
"Killers?"
"Often."
"Bombers?"
"Their crimes are not the issue here."
"They most certainly are the issue," Anita said. "Dr. Cross has a reputation for going after the worst criminals, taking on the biggest cases, isn't that so?"
"He's well regarded as an investigator."
"Did Dr. Cross put himself in personal danger to solve the cases you looked at?"
"Every cop in America is in danger every day."
"Point taken," Anita said. "But in light of the kinds of cases Dr. Cross worked for the FBI and DC Metro, wasn't he bound to come into contact with more violent suspects than the average cop?" Nixon paused and then said,
Probably a higher incidence of contact with that sort of criminal, but I can't tell you what that is statistically.
A higher incidence of contact will do, Anita said, and she smiled at the jury as she went back to the defense table. She put on reading glasses and scanned her notes for a moment. When she was done, she pivoted and looked at the witness. Just to summarize, Mr. Nixon, in each of the 9 fatal cases you looked at, Dr. Cross, because of his job, came into close contact with a hardened criminal, correct? He thought about that and then said,
correct.
And violence ensued, she said.
Violence ensued and someone died by Cross's hand.
Anita removed her glasses and cocked her head at him. In those 9 fatal incidents, Mr. Nixon, how many times did Alex Cross shoot first? He cleared his throat.
It's more telling to look at escalation, Ms. Marley.
How many times did Dr. Cross shoot first? Nixon looked ready to argue, but then said,
0.
0? She said, looking at the jury. And how many times did Alex Cross shoot first in any of the wounding incidents?
0.
0, Anita said, looking right at jurors 5 and 11. Not once in Dr. Cross's career has he fired his weapon in anything but self-defense. He deals with the worst of the worst. He tries to avoid conflict, but these people are violent. And he has the right to defend himself. Isn't that right, Mr. Nixon?
No, Nixon said. That's not right. Cross seeks conflict. He charges in.
Sounds to me like a brave cop doing his job.
Objection, Will said. Sustained, Judge Lodge said. The jury will ignore that.
But of course, they couldn't. I could see in jurors 5 and 11 that Anita's line of questioning had been effective and revealing. To those two, at least, maybe I wasn't the out-of-control cop the prosecution described earlier. I have nothing further for this witness, Your Honor, Anita said. Will stood and said,
the prosecution calls Kimiko Binks.
Chapter 52. Kimiko Binks raised her right arm and took the oath. A fit Asian American woman in her late 20s, Binks wore a chic gray pantsuit. Since I'd seen her last, she had grown out her hair and gotten it cut in a geometric style. She perched in the witness chair and slowly swept her gaze around the courtroom, looking at everyone, it seemed, but me.
You may proceed, Mr. Wills,
Judge Lodge said, and she coughed. The assistant U.S. attorney adjusted his pants, grinned sheepishly at the jury again, and then said,
Miss Binks, what is it you do exactly?
Web design and coding, she said.
Good at it?
Very.
Well, Will said, and he smiled at the jury once more. Do you remember the afternoon and early evening of March the 29th?
Like it was yesterday.
The prosecutor led Binks through her version of events. She reported that she'd found me waiting for her outside her apartment door when she came in from a run, that I'd tracked her through a website dedicated to Gary Sinigi that she'd designed, and that I asked her to take me to see her partner in the website, Claude Watkins. What's your big interest in Gary Sinigi? Wills asked. Binks shrugged.
It was a phase. Like that woman who wrote the book where she visits all the graves of assassinated presidents? Kind of ghoulish but interesting at the moment, you know?
So you're not obsessed with Gary Sinigi?
Not anymore. Seeing friends of mine killed for their intellectual interests soured me on it.
Objection, Anita said. Sustained, Judge Lodge said. The jury will ignore the last statement.
Wills bowed his head, crossed to the jury box.
So you led Dr. Cross to an abandoned factory to see Mr. Watkins, isn't that correct?
Binks nodded and said that Claude Watkins and some of his friends had been using the old factory as an art studio and living space.
Did you coerce Dr. Cross in any way to go find Watkins?
She leaned forward to the mic.
I didn't have to. He wanted to go.
But you wanted him there as well, correct?
Well, Claude did. That's right.
Why is that?
Claude's an artist, visual and performance. He thought it would be interesting and telling to see what Cross would do if he were confronted with one Sinigi after another.
Under further questioning, Binks continued her tale in mostly accurate fashion, until she had us moving deeper into the factory and reaching a large rectangular room. At that point, she began to lie through her teeth. Will said,
"When you went inside, was Claude Watkins at the far end of that long room wearing the Saniji disguise?"
"Yes," Binks said.
"Was Mr. Watkins armed?"
"No." "No nickel-plated revolver in his hand?"
"No."
"Claude had his hands open, and he turned his palms to show Cross." Chapter 53. I leaned over to Naomi, whispered, "That is categorically false." My niece patted me on the arm.
"Don't worry, we'll get our chance."
Will said, "What happened next?"
"Cross aimed his gun at Claude and told him to drop the gun and get down on the floor."
"Did he?"
"He didn't have a gun, but Cross didn't seem to care. I knew he was going to shoot Claude, so I hit Cross's gun hand. Claude took off and tried to hide."
"What was Dr. Cross's state before you hit him?"
"He was acting weird, creepy."
"In what way?"
"Sweating. Looking like he was loving the fact that he was aiming down on Claude. You know, like he dug it."
Will's crossed to a blown-up diagram of the factory floor and pointed at the far left end of the rectangle.
"Watkins was here before he ran?"
"Yes, in front of that alcove."
"What happened then?" For the first time, Binks looked over at me.
"Cross went crazy."
"Objection!" Anita cried. "Overruled," Judge Larch said. "Continue." Binks testified that Virginia Winslow stepped out of the shadows of an alcove in the middle of the far long side of the factory room, and that I then shot Saniji's widow without provocation.
"Was Mrs. Winslow armed?" Wills asked.
"No way," Binks said. "She hated guns."
"Tell us why she was part of this performance in the first place."
"Virginia told me that she couldn't get away from Saniji's legacy, so she decided to try to make art out of it. A bitter commentary, you know."
"And Dr. Cross shot her?"
"Right in the chest. I couldn't believe it. I started screaming, but he didn't care. He just kept shooting. Claude and then Lenny Diggs."
"All of them unarmed?"
"Yes. And after he shot Lenny, he was swinging his pistol around and yelling for more."
"What exactly was Dr. Cross yelling?"
"Like, who's next? Come on, you bastards. I'll kill every single Saniji before I'm done."
Wills looked at the jury. "I'll kill every single Saniji before I'm done." Juror 5 was shaking his head. Juror 11 was shaking hers. Wills rubbed his hands together as if he were washing them and said, "Thank you, Ms. Banks. That must have been difficult. Your witness, Ms. Marley." Chapter 54. Anita had been scribbling notes on her legal pad. She looked up and said,
"Your Honor, the defense asks the court's leave to delay our cross-examination of Ms. Binks, pending an ongoing line of inquiry we are following."
"An ongoing line of inquiry?" Wills asked.
"Right," Anita said.
Judge Larch didn't like that. "How much of a delay are you asking for?"
"I would think tomorrow afternoon would work, Your Honor."
Larch got a sour look on her face, but then seemed to think of something that brightened her mood. She said, "Ms. Binks, you're excused for the day. 10 minutes recess before Mr. Wills calls his next witness." The judge banged her gavel, got up fast, and hurried for the door, no doubt dreaming of that first puff. Larch came back in a much better mood exactly 10 minutes later. She returned to the bench, popped a mint, and said, "Mr. Wills?" "The prosecution calls Claude Watkins to the stand." I heard a creak as the double doors to the courtroom swung open. I turned to see a man in a wheelchair being pushed by Gary Saniji's son, Dylan. Claude Watkins was in his late 40s with salt-and-pepper hair, a stubbled beard, and a buff upper body. A blanket hid his withered legs. Dylan left him at the bar, and Claude Watkins rolled the chair over in front of the witness stand. The prosecutor looked at Judge Larch and said, "I'd like to treat the witness as hostile. He has been highly uncooperative." Larch glanced at the man in the wheelchair who looked fuming mad.
You going to answer questions under oath? She asked.
Depends on what's asked, Watkins said, not looking at her. She ordered the bailiff to administer the oath, which she did without enthusiasm.
How are you, Mr. Watkins? Wills asked.
Watkins sneered at him.
About as good as you can be when you're confined to a wheelchair and have to use a catheter to take a piss.
How did you wind up in that chair?
Watkins's face bunched up in loathing before he pointed at me and said,
He put me in it. Cross. Shot me for no good reason.
Objection, Anita said. Overruled, Judge Larch said. She popped another mint into her mouth.
Will said, Can you take us through the events of March 29th?
Watkins grudgingly said he'd gotten interested in Saniji and then me by accident. But the more he read about me, the more he was convinced I was borderline out of control when it came to the mass murderer. He testified that he decided to entice me into a situation that could result in an interesting and revealing piece of performance art. He would lure me to an abandoned factory where he'd confront me with one Saniji after another.
So you could see his reaction? Wills asked.
Oh, hell no. I wanted everyone in the world to see Cross's reaction.
Beside me, Anita cocked her head to one side. Will squinted as if he'd heard something new from the witness and said,
How are you going to do that?
By filming it, of course, Watkins said.
What? Will said.
What?
Naomi whispered.
Anita said,
What the hell is... You had to have found him, Watkins said. I mean, you had to have searched the factory and found the smartphones with the add-on lenses, right?
Anita and the prosecutor's assistant both shot to their feet.
Objection! They shouted.
Anita said,
Judge, there has been no mention of any such cameras or phones in discovery.
Because we found no cameras or phones, Will said. Watkins looked like he wanted to spit in disgust.
I put them there myself. What is this, a cover-up? I was wondering why you weren't badgering me about them from the get-go. I'm telling you, we got the whole thing from three different angles.
Chapter 55. The courtroom erupted. Judge Larch banged her gavel, demanding order. She told the jury to ignore Mr. Watkins' testimony for the time being and ordered both prosecution and defense into chambers, along with the U.S. Marshals who worked in her courtroom.
Judge, the government asked that it be given time to find the phones Mr. Watkins claims are in that factory, Will said when they were all in chambers.
Judge, there is no way to know if these phones, if there are any, have been put there after the fact as a ploy by Mr. Watkins, Anita said. Whatever is on them should be excluded.
The factory has been sealed for months, Will said,
but not guarded.
We don't even know if the phones exist, Ms. Marley, Judge Larch said.
She looked at one of her marshals.
Collins, you and Avery, please go talk to Mr. Watkins. Find out where he says he hid these phones. Call a forensics team and go look. If you find them, establish a perfect chain of custody and bring them here.
Judge, that's the rightful role of the government, Will said.
We're seeking swift truth and justice here, Mr. Wills, Larch said. If the cameras are there and they do show what happened that day, we'll all see it together at the same time, here in my chambers.
The marshals left. The judge ordered that the jury be sequestered and given lunch. We ate down the hall, all of us wondering how the cameras could have been missed, and me worrying about the confidence with which Watkins had revealed them. What would they show? An hour later, word came that three smartphones with extender lenses had been discovered where Watkins said they'd be, in recesses cut into the factory's support beams, hidden with thin pieces of sheet metal. An hour after that, Larch's marshal entered her chambers with three evidence bags, each holding an iPhone 6S. They were dusty and their batteries were dead. Between the group of us, we had enough cords to recharge the devices. One by one, they blinked on. Claude Watkins was asked to provide the security codes for the phones, which he did. They all used his birthday. U.S. Marshal Avery, a thin woman with an intense bearing, wore gloves to enter the codes. Then she attached the first phone to a laptop computer and the laptop to a screen on the wall of Judge Larch's chambers.
15 minutes later, as the last of the three videos played, there was dead silence in Judge Larch's chambers. I felt steamrolled and had no doubt I was heading to a federal pen for a long, long time.